Hello, and welcome to The Iberian Knot, a history of the Spanish Civil War, episode 14, On the Ground and Around the World. Glad to be back with you this week. I wanted to start this week's episode by pausing and taking a look at a couple of people directly involved in the war. One at the very top of the power hierarchy, and one almost at the bottom. President of the Republic, Manuel Lasagna, and famed author of Homage to Catalonia, Animal Farm, and 1984, George Orwell. Both of these men were present at the time of Barcelona's May Days, when the Communist and Esquerra or Catalan independence parties, which held the majority of power and influence in the military and main government in Valencia, and the anarchists in alliance with the POUM carried out a civil war within the civil war in Barcelona. Orwell, whose given name was Eric Blair, had gone to Spain to volunteer to fight with the POUM militias in December 1936, after becoming enamored with the romanticized view of the Spanish Civil War in England as a struggle between democracy and fascism. He was at that time in his early 30s. Manuel Lasagna was already in his late 50s at the same time and had been in government as a deputy minister and prime minister since 1931 and president since May 1936. Both men came from upper-class families, meaning that they had effortless access to all of the human necessities of life that many of the people that were fighting under or with them could only dream of, such as food, a world-class education, professional connections, disposable incomes, and the ability to take vacations and travel the world. Nonetheless, both men would spend their lives attempting to improve the lives of the majority of people beneath them in regards to class and economic status. Born in 1880 into a rich, influential, and politically active family, his father had been the mayor of his hometown of Alcalá de Henares outside of Madrid. Manuel Lasagna's political beliefs were built on the 19th century liberal ideas of the Enlightenment, inspired mainly by the French tradition. After getting his doctorate in law, he became part of a political movement that valued and promoted universal education and partial suffrage, the removal of noble privileges, and the suppression of the church's influence in society. He was not for the dissolution of all large estates and the redistribution of that land en masse to the people, or for the workers to take over ownership of the factories and the agricultural workers, that of the farms, like his socialist and anarchist contemporaries. During his time in government, he did implement reductions in military spending, introduced work accident insurance, and attempted to wrest away from the Catholic Church the job of educating the populace and to transform it into a state-sponsored secular institution like in other countries. But his apathy towards more radical 20th century political ideas like land redistribution and collective ownership of industry, in conjunction with his attacks on the power of the military and the church, made him enemies on all sides. He was unable to satisfy the communists, socialists, and anarchists when he was prime minister, which led to them losing the elections against the conservatives during the Second Republic. And when he successfully reunited the left and won subsequent elections with his popular Front coalition, he couldn't tamp down the violence and discord that came thereafter. In the end, by placing him in the presidency, the government found a way to remove him from practical power and transform him into a figurehead for increasingly left-leaning governments to point to as a sign of their moderation in their conversations with foreign governments that were at the time afraid of communism and Russia's influence. This meant that he was left with not much to do but sit around and watch things deteriorate around him. In an earlier episode, I related that when the nationalists first started to approach Madrid, that Lasagna was sent off to Barcelona for safety reasons, while the rest of the government decamped to Valencia. There he lived in the Palacio de la Ciudadela, which means Palace of the Citadel, and now goes by the Palau del Parlament de Catalunya, or the Palace of the Parliament of Catalonia. There he wrote La Velada en Benicarló, which can be translated as The Vigil in Benicarló, but could also be translated as The Evening in Benicarló, a city on the coast of Valencia. I like to think of it as The All-Nighter in Benicarló, as it kind of brings together those two meanings. This novel is in the form of a conversation between a small group of people that takes place one night in an imaginary hostel in that town, which was about halfway between Barcelona and Valencia, where Azaña and the Prime Minister Largo Caballero would often meet. Azaña tried to say that the characters weren't direct representations of real-life people, but historians and critics were able to link many of the characters to people Azaña knew and worked with. In this conversation, Azaña pointedly leaves out any voices of the regionalists or anarchist movements. And importantly, there is only one woman present, an actress, and I counted that she says exactly two sentences. This is relevant as it shows that despite Azaña's many years working as a journalist and politician, that he was still at a remove from some of the largest and most important groups of people who were working, fighting, and indeed being captured, tortured, and dying on his behalf. Nonetheless, there are some truths about Spain's situation in summer 1937 that can be extracted from this narrative, and some relevant questions he asked about Spain and the larger world that people on at least the Republican and Democratic countryside could not face. An idea that comes across in the sections of dialogue where the characters are clearly speaking Azaña's personal thoughts is that the Republicans were hobbled by their pacifist sensibilities and their inability to find common cause. This does not take into account that he himself had sent in Franco to quiet the left-wing strikes with violence in the mines of Cantabria during his time in government during the Republic. At the same time, he cries out against those militaristic supporters of the government that are all for continuing the fight until the bloody end, saying that they seem like, quote, henchmen of the Hebraic God, who for his glory squishes men like grapes for wine. But he makes it clear that despite all of Republican Spain's internal issues, before and during the Civil War, that the odds have been against them from the outset. One character notes, in order of importance, the enemies of the Republic are Anglo-French politics, the armed intervention of Italy and Germany, the excesses in discipline and the subordinate goals that have impaired the reputation of the Republic and the authority of the government, lastly, the rebels' own forces. In retrospect, it's hard to understand exactly what the democracies of the world hope to achieve by ignoring the takeover of a flawed but legally voted in government by a military insurrection that was subsequently supported by every authoritarian fascist government in Western Europe. For Spaniards on the Republican side in the midst of the war, it was unendingly infuriating. In regards to the excesses in discipline and subordinate goals, this was a reference to the fact that at the outset of the war, the Republican government had been powerless to stop the extrajudicial killings of conservative politicians and members of the clergy, as well as the destruction of church buildings all across the territory they theoretically held. This did little to boost their international image and allowed their enemies to paint them with a broad brush in their propaganda. This was coupled with the breaking off of towns, communities, and many centers of industry into communes or collectively owned enterprises that were driven by the political ideals of the individual group, as opposed to the collective Republican war effort. The rebels' own forces reflected the continued war Azaña would have received reports of and heard from his windows between internal factions on the Republican side that had led to the illegalization of the POUM and the almost complete marginalization of the anarchists by fall 1937, right before this book was completed. He questions why the Spanish are killing each other, and why a huge group of his countrymen has allowed Moroccans, Germans, and Italians to more or less make a colony of Spain in order to achieve their ends. Was violence a national characteristic, as so many at the time would have stereotypically described all Latins as innately having, or was it some special set of circumstances that had led them to this point? Only a little over 20 years prior, Spain was one of the few countries in Europe who decided not to take part in the Great War, a war in which millions had thrown themselves into machine gun fire day after day for years simply because they were ordered to do so by their sovereign monarchical or democratically elected government. Now the inverse was happening, and all of Europe and America was coming to Spain to fight out their political grievances, and the Spanish welcomed them all. He wondered why the nationalists were so willfully allowing the Germans and Italians to enter the country, but had not he, Caballero, and the rest of the government allowed the USSR to do much the same, while they begged England and France to more extensively intervene? Azaña was a tortured soul, no doubt. And while he doesn't seem to strongly self-reflect about his own hypocrisies in the novel, it does come across that he tried to do his best his entire life to foment progressive social changes through nonviolent political means, and concluded at that moment that he had profoundly failed. The book ends with this chilling paragraph. Silence. The sea barely made any noise. The night dissolved into ill-defined gray, attacked by lazy gleams of light. A line on the horizon outlined the spine of the water, its rounded limit. Morning birds, an alert rooster. Plains bruised with houses. An olive tree that the night had left intact. The geometric profile of the Araucaria tree. The great function of the daybreak begins, always with new sounds and colors. Man, prisoner in a dream cocoon, agonizes over disagreeable fantasies, complains like an invalid bug. From the skies fall the airplanes, directed squarely at the town. They are already overhead. A loud clamor. The explosions go off in clusters. Cracking and snapping noises, collapses, dust, flames. Where does such a creature come from? Another pass. The thunder of bombs. Bursts of machine gun fire. The town flees, howls, bleeds out. The town burns. Of the hostel, only bricks remain that give off black smoke, as if they were freshly out of the kiln. The planes, headed back east, glisten in the rays of the sun, invisible from the ground. So, from President Manuel Azaña, we get a pessimistic and world-weary view of the war from the inside. In Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell, he describes his transition from optimistic wannabe freedom fighter to persecuted enemy of the state and cynical observer of events from abroad. Like Azaña, Orwell had grown up a child of privilege and served in what was then called Burma in the Indian Imperial Police at the management level. Upon returning to England, he had become more interested in writing and journalism and was able to reflect on his time in Burma and see how cruel and abusive the UK was to its colonies. While the British lounged on the beaches, the fields would be polluted by their industry and the population ruthlessly exploited for their labor or face harsh punishments or crackdowns. In London, he first investigated the conditions of the poor in that city. Then he moved to Paris, where he lived in a working-class neighborhood and began publishing more often. He then went to study working class conditions in the north of England and discovered that despite having a reputation as being one of the most democratic and progressive nations in Europe, that the working class there worked in life-threatening conditions and were only able to live in squalor off of the wages they received. All along, he was able to survive by living in various homes owned either by his family or employers, showing that while he had great empathy for and interest in the working class, part of the reason he was able to complete all of these investigations and writings was due to the fact that his family had profited off of the inequality of English society for generations. I do not think that this at all takes away from the work that he created in his life. Indeed, Animal Farm and 1984 were two of the few books I actually enjoyed reading in school and would encourage everyone to read if they haven't. But it will better put into context what Orwell was throwing himself into by volunteering to fight in Spain without truly understanding the deprivations he was about to go through. Because in Spain, his connections were with some of the least powerful people in the country, and the service he was signing up for was probably the most thankless, grueling experience he would have endured up to that point in his life. Orwell, or Eric Blair, as was his real name, but I'll just call him George Orwell for clarity's sake, wrote a book on his experiences traveling in the north of England and investigating working conditions, mostly of co-workers, called The Road to Wigan Pier. On this same trip doing research for this book, he was able to attend speeches by all of the political movements that were roiling the country as well as Europe in the mid-1930s. There were communists, socialists, the British Union of Fascists, who were also called the Black Shirts as they imitated Mussolini's fascists in Italy. He commented on how they blamed every problem in English society on a faraway conspiracy of Jews and were eager to use violence against counter-protesters. This shaped his political ideology, which he described as socialist. This is interesting because most people, at least in the U.S., may consider his novels Animal Farm and 1984 to be explicitly anti-socialist or anti-communist, because in America we simply don't have the mindset to distinguish between those two ideas. And indeed, if you Google Orwell and socialism, you find articles by modern-day capitalist conservatives saying that Orwell's books were a dire warning against socialism, and others that talk about Orwell's own socialist ideals. Since literary interpretation is something that is very much biased by the point of view of the reader, I might as well give my stab at explaining this apparent contradiction without trying to repeat what others have written. My own view from reading 1984 and Animal Farm is that these books are explicitly anti-authoritarian and anti-totalitarian, and do not really get into the positive ideas that socialism proposes and Orwell agreed with, such as increased economic equality, the breaking down of class structures, universal health care and education, and providing for every citizen's basic needs. Over time, and especially throughout the Cold War, the meaning of these books went from no society should take these steps to limit the freedoms of their people, even though they have the technology and propaganda capability to do so, to the commies are so terrible that Orwell wrote two books about their horrific society, so anything we do to defeat them would be worth it, including setting up our own thought police, Ministry of Truth, and doublethink. But that's the problem with being nuanced. Humans find it easier to see things in black and white. Delving further into Orwell's view on socialism, I ended up reading one of his essays called Can Socialists Be Happy on the OrwellFoundation.com website, which I highly recommend all of you check out, as the man's essays are extremely witty, cogent, and relevant in 2020. He says, "The real objective of socialism is human brotherhood. That men use up their lives in heartbreaking political struggles or get themselves killed in civil wars or tortured in the secret prisons of the Gestapo, not in order to establish some central heated, air-conditioned, strip-lighted paradise, but because they want a world in which human beings love one another instead of swindling and murdering one another. And they want that world as a first step." End quote. In this same essay, he says that realistic or convincing descriptions of unlimited happiness or utopias are almost impossible for people to imagine, but that vivid descriptions of suffering and hellscapes litter the rhetorical and literary landscape. And this explains why it was easier for Orwell to artfully and compellingly depict the cynical deterioration of a political movement like farm animal socialism into authoritarianism, or the breakdown of a democratic society into a 1984 police state, but wasn't able to produce the same type of stories describing what his idea of a perfect socialist society would look like. He points to Charles Dickens, who, in A Christmas Story, makes the Cratchits happy by magically making one rich man generous over a single night, or how Jonathan Swift was able to envision in Gulliver's Tales societies of anthropomorphic animals that aren't burdened with a human's strong emotions or need for bloodshed, but also lead bloodless, inconsequential lives because they are never presented with any real challenges, either physical or emotional. I'm sorry I'm really going on about Orwell and his political background, but I really admire his writing, and I think the way he's taught in American schools could use a major overhaul. But keep in mind, he wrote that essay about socialism, happiness, and utopias about 7 years after going to Spain. So the man that's arriving in Barcelona in late 1936 was still hoping to help stop fascism dead in its tracks before it took over the whole of Europe. The narrative of homage to Catalonia begins with Orwell arriving in Barcelona and finding what seems like a socialist utopia. He saw left-wing propaganda posters all over the city representing all kinds of political leanings. The people no longer used formal titles or forms of address. He almost never heard the formal usted, and everyone was using the informal too, and calling each other compadre. The waiters and chefs seemed to own and run the restaurants, and the workers under their different political parties had taken over many of the local factories, industries, and docks. The people he meets at the POUM headquarters were clearly of the lower classes and made up of people from all over the world, which convinced him that he had arrived to fight on the right side in the war, without a doubt. But from here, things went downhill fast. He was sent to Huesca. He was sent to the Huesca front in Aragon, which was not only one of the most uneventful places to be sent for the majority of the war, but was incredibly cold in the winter. He left for that front in January, so you can imagine how miserable it would have been. There, he and the other soldiers spent most of their time looking for firewood or other means to stay warm and enough food to survive. He talks about the stupid little arguments that would occur between the troops over the most minor accusations or insults, mostly driven by their hunger and desperation. He also noted that one was as likely to be killed by friendly fire as by the nationalist enemy, as there weren't many uniforms and there were 100 different languages being spoken on both sides of the war. One of his strongest memories of the war was regarding the latrines that they had to use, which were just holes in the ground that had slippery, flat rocks on either side to place your feet on, and were continually backed up and overflowing. He dejectedly observed that he and these other men were fighting for one of the most important causes in the world at the time, but were suffering under conditions worse than the most menial regular army troops in any other European army. His time at the front was mostly miserable and boring. He told one story in another essay produced a few years after the war about how he had spent all of a late night and dawn with another soldier hoping to get a shot at any nationalist that popped his head over a trench line, but when a man finally got up to run a message to his commanding officer, he wasn't wearing a shirt and was holding up his pants with one hand. Orwell said that at the time he told himself he didn't take the shot because it was hard to hit a moving target at 100 yards, but in reality he felt like he couldn't shoot a man that was clearly as ridiculous and human as himself or the men on his side in the war. Orwell went back to Barcelona in April 1937, shortly before the May Days would take place in that city. He was outraged that the POUM were beginning to be painted as stooges, or worse, double agents of the Nationalists, and that members of that party were beginning to be hounded, kidnapped, and tortured by communist militias and secret police using NKVD tactics. The NKVD would later become the KGB, Russia's secret police. He sees the city has changed a great deal from the one he first encountered upon arriving. There were more poor people on the streets, and the class dynamics were beginning to reassert themselves. Seeing that the communists are printing lies about himself and people he knows, he began to see the power of propaganda in framing a narrative for society to rally around. Despite all this, he returned to the Huesca front to fight in the offensive against the nationalists, but soon thereafter was shot in the neck by a sniper. This just missed his carotid artery, and he returned for the last time to Barcelona. By late spring, the POUM was entirely outlawed, and Orwell and his wife Eileen O'Shaughnessy, who came to Spain shortly after Orwell, were considered enemies of the state. The majority of his notes from the front were confiscated and are believed to still be hidden somewhere in the records of the NKVD, which later became the KGB in Russia somewhere. He was forced to go into hiding, and many of his friends were arrested and sent to prison, where they were interrogated, tortured, and then either killed, exiled, or sent to work camps, not by the nationalists, but by those who were theoretically on their same side in the war. He and his wife managed to escape to France and from there back to England. There, he was surprised to find that the majority of people didn't care at all about the war in Spain, and that those that did were blindly supporting the communists despite the great purges that they were carrying out in that country, or that Stalin was carrying out in the larger USSR. He was also stung by the glorification of the violence in the war, coming from the same people who only years before were out-and-out pacifists and didn't know about or acknowledge the horrible realities that they were encouraging others to set off and sign up for. All of the atrocities committed by the so-called whites or nationalists would be highlighted and raged against by the left-wing press, while all those committed by the communists and their secret police were either omitted from the story or outright denied to have taken place. Both sides were effectively deciding what their truth was on a daily basis, but it profoundly disturbed Orwell that the objective truth was being made to be murkier by the day by governments and politically motivated press on all sides through mass media. Over 75 years from then, we can look back and see the situation more clearly, but on the ground at the time, people were looking at all reports from the Spanish Civil War through their own political lens. Some are doing this out of true ideological fervor, while others, such as the major politicians in the democratic countries, were trying to keep their own countries from bubbling over into their own social revolutions, or into an open war with Germany, Italy, or Russia. In retrospect, there is no doubt that Franco was filling concentration camps with hundreds of thousands of prisoners that he could work to death for free or summarily execute if they got out of line. The communist forces and the Spanish Republican government were purging their enemies in the anarchist and POUM parties and either torturing and killing them in secret in Spain or in Russia, torturing them, killing them in secret, or sending them off to Siberia to work camps. But on the surface level, while all of the fighting and intrigue was going on in the summer and fall of 1937, the main European powers were still maintaining the polite farce that there was official non-intervention and a committee with the purpose of perpetuating it. Each country's leadership and that of the Spanish on both sides were complicated, so I'll go through each country's perspective at this time. The Russians had been, along with Mexico, Republican Spain's only open and active supporter during the conflict. They had been sending in war material and officers, as well as pilots and natural resources, while at the same time recruiting people from all over the USSR and the world to go fight for the Republicans all around Spain. However, this assistance was starting to meet a variety of challenges. With the Nationalists having taken over in the north, they effectively controlled the Bay of Biscay, and therefore it would be exceedingly difficult for any supplies or volunteers to reach the Republicans through that waterway going forward. The Italians began to use what at the time was the largest fleet of submarines in Europe to torpedo all types of merchant vessels in the Mediterranean as well, sinking dozens of ships in the second half of 1937 alone. The French border was officially closed, although there was a great deal of smuggling going on at night, aided by bribes or direct intervention from the supporters of Republican Spain and the French government. Those were just problems regarding the direct transport of goods into the country. At the same time, you had Stalin's internal repression of what he reviewed as his secret enemies in the Great Purge, which would send anywhere between hundreds of thousands to millions of people off to prison, torture, death, or work camps based on rumors of treachery, either in thought or in deed, the settling of individual scores, or just a party member's wish to be seen actively purging made-up internal enemies of the state to appease Stalin. This was triggered by the breaking off of Trotsky from the government and Stalin's constant paranoia. In 1937, these purges were at their height, and any military officers or political attachés recalled to Russia from Spain were probably terrified that they would be thrown in a torture prison when they returned home, which in many cases they were. This most definitely didn't help these people trying to do the job of fighting the war on the ground, as they would have weighed every decision they made against the possible ire it would spark in Stalin if it were to fail. At this time, any military failure could be blamed on disloyalty to the government or mark you as a spy planted by the fascists. On top of the challenges presented by the actions of other European nations, all of whom were borderline allies or foes, the USSR and Stalin in 1937 were escalating their involvement in their largest neighbor to the south, China, which was in the midst of their own civil war that started in 1927 and would last until 1950. To make a very long and complicated story short, the USSR was working with the nationalist Chinese government that was actively persecuting the communists in their country in order to help them fight off intrusions from the Japanese. It's clear that Stalin was happy to partner with his ideological enemies when it fit his needs. However, at the exact same time, he was signing the Sino-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact in August with the official nationalist-controlled Chinese government. He was also assisting militarily a largely Muslim-led rebellion in Xinjiang, a far northwestern Chinese province on the Soviet border, to effectively make the area a puppet state of the USSR. This diverted a great deal of attention away from the Spanish Civil War, as well as munitions and other supplies. Russia had a lot of spinning plates at this time, and it's kind of amazing they were able to keep it all going at once. From there, we'll move on to the Germans and Hitler's Nazi Party. Hitler was ramping up his plans to create more Lebensraum, or literally living space, for the German people by invading Eastern Europe in the next year. With this goal in mind, he needed a couple of things from the nationalists in Spain. For the war to continue and create a smokescreen for and distraction from his military buildup, and to receive a great deal of raw materials from the mines of Spain to build up the German war machine. In July 1937, the Spanish nationalists signed a promise that Germany would be their first trade agreement partner, that they would inform Germany of any trade negotiations with any other countries and give most favored nation status to that country. Spain would export in that year alone over 1.6 million tons of iron, 956,000 tons of pyrites, and more than 2 tons of other raw materials to Germany. The way these transactions of raw materials in exchange for debt and military assistance was directed through a few individuals in the Nazi high command present in Spain was open to graft and immense corruption, which the official diplomatic corps of Germany recognized, but they did not make their concerns known to Hitler and his inner circle, as they were not anxious to make enemies with members of Hitler's party. The Italians had just participated in large successful campaigns in the north, and Mussolini was crowing about it back home. He was excited for Italian troops to be used to take down Madrid and end the war with a crowning glory for himself. This put him at odds with Franco and the Nationalists, who appreciated the troop and air support from the Italians, but were frustrated with their commander, a guy named General Bastico, who often refused to take orders from his nationalist superiors and had committed treason in the eyes of Franco and many of his military commanders by allowing the Basques to negotiate a separate peace with the Italians in the final days of the Northern Offensive. Even though we know this tragically fell through, it showed a needless and subversive sympathy for the Reds, as the Nationalists saw all of their enemies at this time. Mussolini seems to have been in the same boat as Stalin, and that neither authoritarian seems to have had a specific, long-term plan when determining their next steps, but rather were just on a constant PR campaign for their personal brand, looking to exploit opportunities where they presented themselves and allowed them to expand their influence and glory. The French government, even though it had recently replaced the socialist Léon Blum with the radical Camille Chautemp, which in this case meant the government had taken a slightly more conservative direction, was probably Republican Spain's best and most powerful friend at that time. Mexico was arguably their best friend, but their ability to assist them was far more limited than France, which shared a border, the Mediterranean, and the Atlantic with them. Unlike the USSR, Germany, or Italy, who were working to expand their borders or press their political ideology on other countries, the French were trying to stifle the intentions of those countries while trying to assist the Republicans in winning the war as best they could. For obvious reasons, they did not want the war to end with the result being a Nazi Germany on their eastern border and a fascist Spain to their south. If they could have had their way, they would have opened up the French border entirely to allow for the transport of assistance to the Republicans, but they were continuously hamstrung by the UK and other democracies that opposed it because they didn't want to add to the violence, antagonize the Germans and Italians, or seem to be openly allying with the communist USSR. The British had for centuries attempted to play the different European countries against one another to maintain a peace on that continent that was most amenable to their interests, and this pattern perpetuated itself in 1937 under the new leadership of Neville Chamberlain. Anthony Eden remained as foreign secretary and was of the opinion that Franco would most likely win the war, even though that was not his preferred outcome. Chamberlain was mostly irritated by the Spanish War and did not want it to take precedence over the government's other diplomatic goals. In late July 1937, a secret letter was sent to offer talks between Mussolini and Chamberlain, which elated Mussolini to receive because it meant his successes in Africa and Spain were making an intimidating impression on the world-straddling British, and he hoped to gain recognition for his conquests in Abyssinia. The French were correctly worried that the British were drifting away from tacit but non-military support for the Republicans in Spain to a gradual acceptance of a nationalist win and of Italian gains on the peninsula and in the Mediterranean. Unfortunately for the Republicans, this made the French compromise their support even further in order to appease the British, who they could not afford to break from completely in case of a war with Germany. With all of these intrigues, desires, and goals, both short and long term, swirling around the political and diplomatic spheres of each country, There were constant fears that an incident in the Mediterranean was going to set off another world war by accident. The Deutschland incident had occurred in May 1937 when a detachment of Soviet bombers had attempted to bomb nationalist naval positions off of the Balearic island of Ibiza and had ended up bombing the German heavy cruiser named Deutschland, or Germany, which killed over 30 sailors and wounded over 70. In retaliation, the German naval forces bombed the Republican-held city of Almeria on the southern coast of Andalusia. Many of the ships in the Mediterranean officially transporting necessary foodstuffs, but clandestinely carrying arms and troops to the Republicans, were manned by British merchants, and these were being torpedoed regularly by Italian submarines. This meant that many within Great Britain were pushing for their navy to intervene, but the government was not excited to go to war to ensure a few shipping millionaires were able to continue their technically illicit commerce. That summer, the new Spanish Prime Minister, Negrín, and his Foreign Minister, José Giral, traveled to Paris to lobby for the government to end its official stance of non-intervention, which would allow for those within France who supported their cause to send assistance without restrictions. They explained that assistance was getting spotty from the Russians for the reasons I mentioned before, and that by allowing democracies to assist them, they could decouple themselves from the USSR and reduce communist influence in their government and military. Remember, one of the main reasons the communists and government wanted Negrín in the role that he currently occupied was because he was of the class and education that could plausibly communicate this argument. While the Republicans were begging the French to end non-intervention, the Nationalists and their international allies were asking for belligerent rights to be granted on the sea, as they now had the most powerful naval force in the Mediterranean. With these rights, they would not even have to conceal their searches and attacks on ships that carried Republican supplies or troops, but they tried to paint this as simply leveling the playing field and allowing Great Britain and France to reduce their naval forces in the area. Many on the British side welcomed this because they were afraid that more British naval vessels in the area would just make for more targets for the Italians. The French completely understood the sleight of hand the Nationalists were trying to pull off and talked about abolishing all frontier control if that plan went through. Negrín saw that French threat as a happy medium, as it would at least provide them with additional support from the north, from which it was much easier to transport people and goods than over waters patrolled by their enemies' warships and submarines. But the French wouldn't carry out that threat just yet. As part of these series of threats and proposals, the Nationalists sent out a message to all foreign powers, but especially directed at the French and English, stating that anyone that opposed belligerent rights at that moment might find themselves locked out of the Spanish economy in the future, which would have set off alarm bells in London and Paris, as both countries had major economic concerns in the peninsula that they didn't want to disrupt, no matter how the war panned out. In July, the British put forth a compromise plan for control of non-intervention, the gist of which was that naval patrols would be replaced with observers on land and at sea to limit intervention, that foreign troop numbers in Spain be drawn down, and that after progress was made on those troop withdrawals, that belligerent rights be granted at sea. Germany was able to accept this as a basis for discussion, easy for them as they had no troops on the ground to recall. But the Spanish Republican government was staunchly opposed to it, as were the Italians, towards whom this agreement was obviously directed. This was also a boon to the Nationalists, as they could send away those Italian troops which they considered extraneous, and the Republicans would have to give up a great deal of those troops and their international brigades, which had helped halt Nationalist offenses multiple times during the war. The Italian representative on the Non-Intervention Committee was able to stifle negotiations of this very mild British agreement by pressing for the order of topics of discussion to begin with belligerent rights and then proceed to foreign volunteer troop numbers. As the belligerent rights were the harder thing to iron out, the discussion went nowhere and the status quo was maintained as the Italians wished. Later in August, the Russian representative on the committee asked the German and Italian members point blank if they would agree to the decrease of foreign troops in Spain on both sides, and he did not receive a clear answer. The stalemate remained. The British and French were getting tired of being stonewalled at every turn, so they proposed a conference for the 10th of September in the city of Nyon in southeast France that invited representatives of all countries with Mediterranean borders, except Spain and including Germany and Russia, with the goal of settling the constant bombings of vessels by the Italians in the Mediterranean. The Italians temporarily ceased their actions in that area, even though Franco asked them to continue it through September to try and permanently hobble the Republicans. Even though this conference was in response to Italian offensive actions in the Mediterranean, and the Germans and Italians refused to join, the meeting still proposed that the Italians have a patrol area allotted to them in the eastern Mediterranean, while French and British fleets would patrol to the west of Malta. The agreement was signed by those parties present on September 14th, which elated the Russians and pissed off the Italians. Mussolini commented to Hitler that no matter the final outcome of these talks, he was going to keep torpedoing where he liked. The French and English invited the Italians to send representatives to propose tweaks to the agreement, which would assuage them. The Italians were thus able to negotiate for themselves a patrol zone between the Balearic Islands and Sardinia, meaning that they would have a zone of privacy through which they could continue to provide assistance to the nationalists and preserve their installations on those islands. At the same time, Juan Negrin had gone to the League of Nations to ask their political committee to investigate Spain and for intervention to be allowed. Anthony Eden argued that non-intervention efforts had stopped a European-wide war from breaking out. In private, Eden communicated to Negrin that British public opinion was against Franco winning, but that the Prime Minister was afraid of communism and couldn't start a conflict with Germany because they weren't militarily prepared for it and the public opinion was against involving Britain in another continental war. In the end, the most the Spanish Republicans were able to wring out of the League of Nations was a tepid document that referred to the failure of non-intervention and admitted to the existence of veritable foreign army corps on Spanish soil. It recommended consideration of ending non-intervention, but the statement had no power behind it and had been made weaker by the British, who removed any condemnation of the actions of Italy or Germany. This can all be chalked up on the board of the many failures of the League of Nations to prevent the military buildup of totalitarian governments and the eventual outbreak of the Second World War. By October, the naval part of the negotiations went to the background as all parties attempted to settle the argument about troop levels. The Italians during this time satisfied Franco's demands by changing out the commander of Italian troops in Spain, General Bastico, with General Mario Berti. The French grew frustrated with the German and Italian impertinence on the issue by declaring that if an agreement wasn't reached by mid-October, that they would open the French border to arms transport to the Republic. This looming threat brought the Germans and Italians to the table, and Eden ran long negotiations to reach an agreement by the first week of November to limit the number of non-Spaniards in both the Republican and Nationalist parts of the country. The Nationalists were happy to agree to this because they had already had some Italian troop drawdowns that they would finagle into looking like they were abiding by the agreement when they had made no changes in their planning in reaction to the agreement. The Republicans hoped that the agreement would lead to a decrease of Nationalist military offensives that would be the first step towards an internationally negotiated peace. In the meantime, the French had kept their word to open the border, and a great deal of material reached the Republicans while these negotiations took place, mostly at night. Eden was also playing a double game, as he encouraged the French to aid the Republicans as much as possible, no matter what was being hammered out officially in the non-intervention committee. This morass of diplomatic machinations was coupled with the historically monumental Anti-Comintern Pact that Italy, Germany, and Japan signed on November 6th, which placed those countries squarely in opposition to the USSR and its international efforts to expand communism. This also scared the heck out of the democratic countries, who had trouble seeing this as anything other than a precursor to another world war. Consequently, the USSR wanted Germany and Italy to continue to have to spend treasure and manpower in Spain, and the Germans and Italians wanted the USSR distracted in as many theaters as possible so they could attack them in their weak spots if necessary. Meanwhile, the British and French wanted the war to continue, as they saw that as the only way for it to come to a negotiated end, with the Republicans retaining some position from which to negotiate terms, as opposed to a massive and conclusive win by the Nationalists and their allies, which seemed to be the only other option. And thus things stood in late autumn of 1937. With the Italians and Germans able to freely transport goods across the Mediterranean and torpedo any ships they didn't like with relative impunity, while the French had closed their border, on paper, due to the agreement reached in the Non-Intervention Committee, and in return the Republicans had vague promises about decreased troop levels that the Nationalists were already actively subverting. Each side felt at least temporarily that they had something to celebrate, and the stalemate at the various fronts stabilized. Next week, we'll delve into the introspection, reevaluations, and next steps carried out by those on the Republican side of the war, and see how the Nationalists are once again deferred from taking the capital of Madrid, despite the wishes of their allies to complete the takeover of that rich, productive, and central communication hub of the country. The winter of 1937-1938 will be one of the coldest and harshest in decades, and an important battle will be taking place in one of Spain's towns with the coldest winters on average, the Battle of Teruel.
Sabes mi paradero en el frente de grandeza, primera línea.